Welcome to the Should Have Bet More podcast presented by Gold Boys. Coming up on the show, Jeff Parles of Sports by the Book will join us. We will go over what was an exciting weekend of college basketball and baseball, and we'll get his thoughts on the Final Four as it is set, and we will get into some baseball here in a minute. Fun to have it back. Good to have it back. Some fun games, but we'll start here with the story, and that is NC State. I was thinking at halftime of this game, Duke was up by six. It had been all chalk all weekend. All the favorites had won. All the favorites had covered, and it was kind of a ho-hum weekend until NC State just exploded, and Duke went a good 6-7 minutes where they just couldn't buy a shot, and Burns did his thing, got enough shooting around. They finally got some shots to fall, and we now have one of the great all-time Cinderella stories. It's amazing with this tournament. What looked like just, hey, this is going to be one of those years we don't get any upsets, a lot of chalk, and that was the case. You look up, and we have an 11-seed, not just an 11-seed in NC State, a team that was, trying to put this in perspective, not going to make the tournament unless they won the ACC tournament, 5 wins in 5 days. And not just that, they were down 1-8-3 Louisville in the first round, the play-in round, the 15 versus 10 matchup of the ACC tournament. Won that game, obviously. They were down 3 with 4 seconds left in the ACC semis against Virginia. Virginia's going to the line to shoot a 1-1 with an 85% free throw shooter. If he makes one of them, the game's over. Even if he didn't, which he obviously didn't. NC State could just Virginia could just foul, and NC State, is going to have a hard time scoring 3 points with 2 free throws. And if NC State loses that game, they don't get in. The coach, from all reports, was gone. He was going to get fired. Now he's going to be there for the next, who knows, 5-10 years. He got an automatic 2-year extension. This is one of the, and not just that, going into the ACC title game, they were like plus 450. They were a good 10-point underdog in the ACC title game against North Carolina. And if you just keep rolling it over, 5-point underdog against Texas Tech. They did get a break where they didn't have to play Kentucky. They got to play Oakland, so they were a 6-point favorite there. But then 7.5-point favorite these last two games, 7.5-point underdog these last two games against Marquette, who couldn't buy a bucket on Friday night. And then on Sunday, down 6 at half against Duke, and NC State wins it. They win it pretty convincingly. They win it going away, and now we have one of the all-time great Final Four runs. And this team was 100-1 to win the ACC tournament. I can't imagine. I'm sure they were 100-1 to make the Final Four before the tournament. I can't even imagine you'd have a realistic odds you'd be able to put on NC State to make the Final Four right before the ACC tournament. I mean, forget it. You'd make you sick thinking about it. Like, if you just woke up with a premonition one day, hey, you know who I think is going to go on a run is that NC State team. March 12th was when this run started against Louisville. If you woke up on March 12th, I got a feeling, I got a hunch this NC State team, they're going to win the ACC tournament, and they're going to the Final Four. I mean, 1,000-1, I wouldn't even know how to put a number on. 1,000-1 wouldn't even be a fair price. I mean, it's just so, just a once-in-a-lifetime kind of accomplishment. And again, look, they really, Oakland had the ball with a chance to win at the end of that game, but they really controlled the game against Texas Tech. I know Marquette missed a million shots, but they led wire to wire against Marquette, down 6 at the half. But once they got a lead, I mean, it was pretty much their game. The last 9-10 minutes or so, there really wasn't much doubt. Once they got up 6-7 points, they just kind of pulled away. They kept them at arm's length. So just an all-time run. Great story. And that leads them against Purdue. Purdue's laying 9 here as our Final Four set. 2 big favorites. I mean, let's face it. We're looking at a Purdue-UConn national title game. I mean, we really are. It's it'd be very surprising at this point if it's not, and that would be a great title game, if it's not Edie versus UConn. Edie is the face of college basketball. We don't have a lot of faces of college basketball with the way these guys just go to the NBA, G League Ignite, all that stuff. We don't have a lot of stars in college basketball. Edie's the one star. Edie's the one people recognize. You have the backstory with Purdue losing so many times is higher seeds, the one seed upset last year that is they lost to Fairleigh Dickinson. Edie's a star. UConn's the marquee team. So that's going to be the title game, I would think. And then you throw in the NC State Cinderella run, Bama with their offense. It's setting up to be a great, great Final Four. What UConn did to Illinois on Saturday was just, I mean, there's no words for it. Just absolutely stunning. At 23-23, they're missing shots. They weren't getting good looks. They were missing threes. And you're like, oh, this is the recipe. UConn having a bad night shooting from the three. They were due for it. And they were due for it. And they got it. At one point, UConn, I think, was 2 of 17 from three, and they were up by 30 points. So, and that's not, this is not Grambling. This is not a 16 seed. It's not Stetson. That was an Illinois team that won the Big Ten tournament. That was an Illinois team that was very good. And they just got blasted by UConn. So I'm sure we're looking at a UConn-Purdue final. The odds suggest we do. I don't think NC State has another one in them. And I picked them on the air On Saturday night against Duke, I thought that they were very live. I thought they were live against Marquette. I don't think they're as live here. I don't know that I'm dying to lay the nine and a half. I don't know that I'm dying to lay that, but I think Edie's too much. And by the way, look, good win for Purdue against Tennessee. That was a tough one for Tennessee. Some of these teams that, you know, blew the games, whether it was Tennessee up 12, you can't say they blew the game, but they were up 12 in the first half. And same thing with Clemson. I think Clemson had a 13-point lead in the first half, and both of them just went away and went away quickly, where they were trailing at halftime, where they were up 12-13, both Tennessee and Clemson, not only in the first half, but pretty late into the first half, where, all right, no way they go into the locker room losing. Well, they did, and they both went on to lose the game. But so good win for Purdue, but the way Purdue is officiated, the way Edie is officiated, is so ridiculous. I mean, you can't breathe on the guy. He's allowed to club people, and he doesn't get called for fouls. It makes it hard to watch the games. It really does. It was very frustrating to watch some of the touch calls on Edie, the foul discrepancy. Now, look, when you got a guy like Edie, you're going to go to the line more than a team like Tennessee. He just doesn't have the ability to go to the line. So I think that's a misnomer that, hey, if the free throws aren't even and this game is rigged or the game's unfair, that's not true. But I do think it's a little much here with Edie going to the line. But that'll be a fun one. If anyone can beat UConn, and I would still pick UConn to win the whole thing. You have the recipe in terms of Edie being able to match Klingon size and not just get dominated by Klingon, where not just match the size, Edie's a little bigger, a little stronger than Klingon, I would say. So, and you just got to hope, hey, Edie holds his own or even more against Klingon, and then you can just bomb in some threes and hopefully win the game. I do think the rest of UConn's roster is much better than the rest of Purdue's roster. So I do think we're looking at a back-to-back title, and I know I keep saying this, I got to figure at some point UConn is down, not even down, tied with 5 minutes to go in a competitive game in the second half, which they haven't done not just this year, but for the last 2 years, just a completely dominant two-year run in the tournament. And it's not like they've got eight or nine guys in the NBA like some of the UConn teams under Calhoun. And even those teams didn't dominate like this. They got a couple pros here and there, and they are just burying people, absolutely burying people. So just impressive what Hurley's done. It really is. And boy, it wasn't that long ago. They went into last year's tournament. Hurley hadn't won a title, a game in the tournament at UConn. He was entering year, I think got there 2018. So he's entering year, five or six, hadn't won a tournament game. Remember, they got upset by New Mexico State in 2021. It was like, hey, what's going on with Hurley? Is this the guy? It's never going to be the same. I'm completely guilty of that. I never thought it would be the level it was with Calhoun. And here they are, just an absolute freight train. And they are laying 11, 11 and a half here against Bama. So fun Final Four. It's NC State kind of saved the weekend, because we're looking at sort of a ho-hum weekend. If we got all chalk, yeah, look, Duke, Purdue, UConn, Bama, that would have been fun. And UConn Purdue is probably the ideal title game. It's too bad how Houston lost, the way Shedd got hurt, because they were about to run Duke out of the building. I felt bad for Shedd, the way that went down. It was like the guy on the linebackers, was it Greenlaw, who got hurt just jumping up and down in the Super Bowl. I mean, that's a tough spot. It's tough to get hurt anytime, but man, of all times, it's just left a bad taste in everyone's mouth. And that certainly affected the result of that game. But great Final Four. Looking forward to it. I still think it's UConn versus Purdue, and I think UConn holds it up. But just a fun weekend here. UConn a -210, -215 favorite to win the whole thing. They were, after their San Diego State win, they were basically even money. I think they were -105 at some books to win the thing, where you could have gotten a field at a reasonable number, -130, -125, basically saying, hey, it's a coin flip. UConn, everybody else, even with three wins left, even just heading into the Elite, that's how dominant UConn's been. So we'll talk to Jeff about that in a minute. Quickly on the baseball, again, great to have it back. The scheduling baseball does is absolutely ridiculous. Thursday, not having anything opening day until like 4 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Eastern was one game, and then most of them started at 4, going up against the Sweet 16. Then Friday, on Good Friday of all days, you got people at home, people off from work, kids home from school. You want to get your younger generation interested in baseball. You're losing out to football, basketball, all that. You got kids home from school. No game scheduled. The only two games, it was 1:40 and 3 o'clock, Braves, Phillies, and Mets, Brewers. And those were makeups because the games Thursday got rained out. You can't make it up. I mean, they just do such a bad job marketing the sport. That being said, fun to have it back. A great weekend for the Yankees. Now, I'm sure Yankee fans are sitting there saying, boy, nice to have these four wins against Houston, but where were these in 2017 or 2019 in the playoffs when all we needed was one or two wins here and there to bust through and get to a World Series? But just not only to sweep all four games in Houston, which is a tremendous accomplishment, and it's amazing how bad Houston's been on the road. If you date back to last year, this is now 9 straight losses at home for Houston, which is basically unheard of. Not just the wins, but the way they won, coming from behind Thursday, Friday, Saturday, all those games were sort of carbon copies of each other where weren't doing much early in the game. They trailed, they tied it, they took a lead, and then they held on at the end. And then Sunday was the best win of all, and it was about to be a bad – it went from being a great win. It looked like it was going to be a bad loss as Holmes was very shaky, and he is a major concern. He is not lights out. He is not a big-time closer or a big-time team. But it went from being, hey, this would be a great win. You go into the Sunday game saying, hey, this is gravy if we can get this. Even at worst case, we won 3 out of 4. You're up 3-1, and then it gets tied. You say, all right, you don't want to let this one get away. Soto gets the hit. You get that little 2-out magic late in the game. Soto with a big hit after Torres gets on base, and then trouble starts where he's like, oh, man, I don't want to lose it like this. Birdie makes a great play. Alvarez hits one to basically the warning track where I thought off the bat he might have hit a 3-run walk-off homer. And then Tucker hits one where Verdugo makes a sliding catch, and just a great series, a great set of wins. And this Yankee team, the last few years, they've been too right-handed. They've been too slow, too unathletic. They hit into a lot of double plays. They're not balanced. They're not deep. When Judge goes down, and he's really, it's been a habit where he gets hurt. Other than the year where he had the monster 60-plus homer season in 2022, it's basically a given that he's going to get hurt at some point. Their offense would fall off a cliff. That's not the case this year. They are good. They're deep. They're balanced. The lefty power with Soto, Verdugo. In past years, recently, even teams that made the playoffs, made the ALCS, you can pass 3 or 4 in the lineup. You're like, oh, you don't need to watch this inning. It's just automatic out after automatic out. There's not a lot of automatic outs. Cabrera is contributing. He got a ton of big hits. And again, guys like Verdugo, and you throw in Rizzo, Stanton, there's no pressure on him. Torres, who's not counted on to be a premier guy, he can just kind of chip in and be a role player. That's a good lineup. It's a deep lineup. Again, they don't have enough starting pitching. They need Cole back. And even with Cole, you wonder, hey, are the Clark Schmidts, are the Cortez, Rodon, Stroman, is that enough? I don't know. Probably not. But with that offense and you get Cole back, that's a start. You're in the conversation. You're definitely a playoff team, but they definitely need to do something about the ninth inning. Again, Holmes saved three games here. So you're sitting here saying, what are you complaining about? He saved all three games. Thursday, he's very lucky to get out of the game with a win. Soto threw the guy out at the plate. Today, they were hitting line drives all over the place, easily an inch here, an inch there. He blows that game. So he could very easily have 2 blown saves in 3 days. So again, I don't know what you do. It's not like there's a logical next guy to step in and be the closer. Maybe Loaisiga. They got a bunch of good setup guys. They don't have that great guy where you can just plug him in and say, all right, Holmes, you're going to need Holmes to get big outs, whether it's the seventh, eighth, he's going to have to be one of the guys. So he could just as easily blow the game in the seventh or eighth. So I don't know what you do with him, and they're not going to do anything now. He's 3-for-3 in saves, but definitely something to keep an eye on. Definitely not trustworthy. He can lose the plate. He getting hit. I mean, he had a stretch when they traded for him when he was absolutely dominant, but that feels like a long time ago now where he's very untrustworthy. When he goes in there with a 1-run lead, you know it's not going to be easy. Even if he gets it done, you know there's going to be base runners. You know there's going to be traffic on the bases. And it's an uneasy feeling with him with a 1-run lead. I don't trust him. But again, it's April. I don't know what you're doing for a closer. It's not like maybe at some point you call up the Mets and say, hey, you guys aren't going anywhere. And it looks like they're probably not going anywhere again. We're only 3 games in, but 3 games is 100% of the sample size. So it's not a lot to go by, but it's all we have to go by. Maybe you can get Diaz. Maybe you get somebody. Maybe we'll see the Yankees be aggressive here because they have a good team. They got a little magic. They've got a little karma. Again, it's only a weekend, but I like the feel of this team as long as they can stay healthy, which is always a big if with them. If you can keep Judge and Soto on the field and some of these other guys and just keep your team on the field, they're going to hit. They're going to score runs. They have a good team and they have a fun team. So impressive from the Yankees. Some other things just around the league. Like I mentioned, Mets, awful weekend, 0-3. I thought they'd have a good lineup. I didn't like their pitching. They were one of the unders I gave out before the season. The Rockies are awful. The Pirates, 4-0. I know the Pirates started off good last year. They started off well last year. And I think on the show right before the season started, the Wednesday show with Mitch, I mentioned, hey, the Marlins are a team I'm looking to go under because they had so many one-run wins last year. That's not something that's you can expect to duplicate going forward. That was a little fluky. They were completely outscored. When you look at some of the advanced stuff, they should have never had a record as good as they had. And we've already seen that starting to correct a little bit. They're 0-4. I'm rooting for the Pirates. Pirates would be fun. I hope the Pirates, I don't know, are they worth, can they possibly win that division? I don't know about that, but they haven't been good in a while. That's a loyal fan base. Cruz is a fun player. They got Skeens in the minors. Maybe the Pirates can stay in the mix here and at least be in the mix for a wild card. So, again, it's only 4 games, but fun to have them in the mix. Hopefully they can make a run the Pirates. So good weekend for the Pirates. Good weekend for the Yankees. Just nice to have it back. I mean, once it's back, that's the good thing. It's every day. You look up and Wednesday and Monday, there's games. You know, Braves, White Sox in the afternoon, Cubs play in the afternoon, Pirates, Nationals. You can pretty much put a game on at any point and put a TV on at any point during the day on a weekday. And usually you're going to have games, despite the fact that baseball just completely lost when it comes to scheduling these games. So happy it's back. Pirates plus 850 to win that division. Is that enough? I don't know. I mean, it's a fun one. Can they win 85, 86 games? Some of this young talent marinates. Maybe they make a trade at the deadline. Probably getting ahead of ourselves, but I don't know. I made dumber bets, that's for sure. So good for the Pirates, rooting for them. They are 4-0. Yankees are 4-0. Baseball is back, and Jeff Parles is back. We will talk to him next about the Final Four, first weekend of baseball. That is next. This is the Should Have Bet More podcast. All right, we are back. Should Have Bet More podcast. He is back. Jeff Parles from Sports by the Book. We'll talk a little Final Four, Major League Baseball. Jeff, what's going on, man?
You know, it's amazing. The calendar's turning to April. The Mets are already 0-3. It's hey, look, it's a great time of year. And as I jokingly said to you before we started recording, we got two very interesting matchups in Arizona that I don't think anyone could have expected what we're getting in the Final Four. Will,
we'll start there and we'll get to baseball. You can use this as a therapy session for you, because it's funny. I think you might be the first third time member of this pod. And nice. The first time you were on, I'm optimistic about the Mets. This was before Senga was hurt. I could see 85 wins. If you get in the playoffs, who knows? Then the next time it was after the Senga injury, you're like, oh, I'm not as optimistic. Then it's we're slowly going backwards in terms of the optimism. We got to start with the basketball. I guess I'll put it this way. Can you make a case for either underdog in these Final Four games? Is there anything that prevents us from a UConn-Purdue final? And if so, what is it?
All right. Well, you know what? I'll make a case for both of them, even though I don't buy the Alabama case. Alabama's variance is so high. I mean, look, just look at what they are. They're a team that shoots a ton of threes. And look, if Alabama somehow has one of those games, Will, where they hit 17, 18 threes, which I know sounds crazy to people on the surface, but it's not out of the realm. They're going to take 35. I mean, look, you get one random good variant shooting game from Alabama from three. Yeah, you know what? They can stay in the game, maybe pull the upset. I mean, the weird thing about the regional final with UConn is, I mean, they didn't even play well on offense until that 30-0 run. I mean, if Illinois had any semblance of offense, Illinois might have been up 10 at halftime, and a 30-0 run would have been from a tie, instead of going from a tie game to a 30-point lead, would have been from down 10 to up 20. But the UConn is such a behemoth, man. It's pretty amazing that they're actually significantly better than they were a year ago when they steamrolled to the title in the NCAA tournament. They just demolish everyone. Klingon is so good on the defensive end, as good of a shot blocker as I wasn't alive when Mutombo was at Georgetown. And if I was, I don't remember it. Same thing with Mourning. But I mean, it's that kind of thing at this point, with the shot blocking ability. The guards are great. Hurley's a wacko, but he's an amazing coach. But then the other game's interesting. First off, I will say this. I'm happy we don't have to watch Purdue-Duke, because there was really no redeeming qualities about this Duke team. I'm happy they're gone, Will. Edie's going to win Naismith Player of the Year. He's vastly improved from he was a year ago. But watching Purdue games is just such a chore. It's not fun. And especially if you attempt to bet the other side, because the refs are just, it feels like they're on this one-way mission to ridiculous. Get Purdue to the national championship game. I understand Edie's a 7-foot monster that actually has some skill, which usually guys that big in college basketball are inept skills-wise. But the refs have no idea how to officiate them. And it's part of the reason I thought Tennessee was a better basketball team than Purdue, but I didn't even bother betting them. Because after watching the Tennessee-Creighton game, and it's like, well, okay, you know what? Tennessee was very physical. They got the right officiating crew for that game that didn't call much. Tennessee only committed 15 fouls in that game against Creighton. There's no way they're getting out of there without Purdue probably shooting 30 free throws. And what happened? It was another insane foul game where Zach Edey somehow only commits one foul in 40 minutes. It's insane how he is officiated. It's insane how really the national media, I hate to go that route, but the college basketball centric media doesn't care. They flat out don't care, but it's a huge story. It is the biggest story to me in this tournament, where Purdue, look, they waxed Gonzaga. They destroyed Utah State. The 16 seed wasn't happening a second straight year. But that was the big story to me in the Tennessee game. It was that Tennessee blew the 11-point lead at the end of the first half. And then when they tried climbing the mountain, it was either Kinect missing a three or them calling a BS foul on the balls inside trying to defend Edie. For NC State, I expect Burns to have two fouls in the first few minutes. Diarra to have two fouls in the first few minutes. There's no reason to think that it won't happen again with America's darlings right now. Again, I think Purdue will win. I think UConn will win. And I think as long as the refs for a title game, assuming it's UConn-Purdue, as long as the refs don't saddle Klingon with two immediately, I don't see how Purdue is competitive in that game against UConn. UConn will just they can defend them well. They have the length on the perimeter to make Purdue's guards struggle. Klingon is obviously the one guy who can really match up shot for shot with Edie in the post. And as long as the refs don't do something stupid, there's no reason to think UConn's not going to win both of these games by double figures and do back-to-back tournament runs by 10 points or more in every single game, which is just unfathomable greatness there, Will.
Point spread for either game. Who would you bet? Is it worth betting? UConn, we got laying 11.5. We got Purdue laying 9.5. If I force bet you on either one, which way are you going?
I lean to just, wow, those lines are pretty good, Will. I know it sounds crazy.
I know what you're going to say, and I'm totally with you.
If you made me bet it, I probably would actually lay it with Purdue. And it pains me because I love this NC State team. The story is insane. DJ Burns is awesome. DJ Horn has been so good in this tournament. But at some point, the run's got to come to a screeching halt. And like I said, I really do think that the refs will put two fouls on DR and two fouls on Burns immediately. And I don't know how NC State can compete with that. I think of all the four sides potentially there, I think Purdue laying the points is probably the best of all of them.
Oh, interesting. When I said I know what you're going to say, and I'm with you. I thought you were going to say you take the points with Bama because
that's the second best one, because here's the problem. Well, I kind of made it a rule for myself that I'm just not betting these Bama games pre-flop because their variance is just so high because of the way they play, where they're not shooting three. If Alabama goes let's say Alabama goes 6 of 28 from three. They're going to lose by 25 points to UConn. They're going to get annihilated if that happens. But, I mean, look, they hit 10 threes, which probably would be about average for them. All right, they could lose the game by 9 and cover the number and still lose a game that's not really competitive. So, yeah, I think of the two dogs, I'd rather have Bama. And I know that's weird to say with the dominance of UConn, but I think I'd rather have Purdue as a favorite over UConn just for the variance of Alabama.
And here's the thing with Bama, if you're serious about winning the game, and there is a recipe, and like you said, it just hit a zillion threes, be up 12-4, be up 14-6, be up right off the bat where, hey, UConn, you look up at the scoreboard. We haven't been down 8 too many times in this tournament the last 2 years. So let put UConn in a position where, look, they're good enough where they can certainly dig out of it, but make them at least think twice. Make them at least put in a position where they're playing catch-up and not just the hammer versus the nail.
No, 100%. And again, I think UConn, I know they weren't really down in the Illinois game, but I mean, that was an ugly first half for UConn. I just couldn't make a shot outside of 2 feet. And you know, that's the really amazing part of that 30-0 run, Will. Usually when you get some psychotic run like that, it's because the team just starts pouring in threes. UConn made 2 3-pointers in a 30-0 run. It's nothing. It's just incredible what this team is. But you're right. Let's say that at the under 12 timeout of the first half, Alabama's up 20-9. All right, well, then maybe we can get a little bit crazy here. And Bama, again, like I said, they're just so high variance where you get a good shooting night. And also, actually, we talk about this all the time when we get to the Final Four. Well, we're in the football stadiums now. It's not the natural sight lines for the shooters. That is the biggest hesitation with Bama here. It's like, uh-oh. What happens if the sight lines aren't good? Of course, then on the flip side of that is we know what happened in 2018 with Villanova when they set Kansas ablaze in that national semifinal where they made the 21 threes.
No, absolutely. And let's just, we'll fast forward ahead and we'll get ahead of ourselves. Let's assume it is UConn Purdue. What's that line look like? And I get the sense you're leaning towards Purdue. What
I'm laying UConn. I'm laying UConn as long as it's not out of control.
What are we thinking? Four, five?
I would personally make it six, but I don't think it'll come that high. UConn just so much better than Purdue is. And again, I hate that this has to be part of the handicap. But the only way that I see Purdue beating UConn is if the refs get fully involved, which can happen with Purdue games, as we know. So, the Purdue's recipe to win that game is the guards play well and Edie gets Klingon in foul trouble. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, well, the best possible matchup against Klingon is out of the first half, two fouls in the first 6 minutes. Like, that's Purdue's path. Which also, again, I hate to go back to Creighton. It's really a shame Creighton lost that game to Tennessee. I thought that was the matchup that I really wanted to see Purdue before potential Final Four. And I know Tennessee gave him a great game. But Kalkbrenner is one of the three big guys in America that actually can guard Edie straight up. Klingon is another one. It'll be interesting to see when you finally have an actual big that can go straight up against Edie. We just have to see how it's officiated.
Yep. Any final thoughts on college basketball before we move to baseball? I do think that that is the dream matchup. I mean, Edie's the star of college basketball. We don't have too many faces of college basketball. These guys come and go so quickly. It's not like it was when we were kids. But he's the star, and UConn's the team in college basketball. So you have the team and you have the player. It's just that's the perfect matchup, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, look, I still would be surprised if we don't get it. I will say, if you got UConn NC State, that would be very interesting. I mean, you're in a scenario where, it's David versus Goliath. It's essentially the same storyline as 1983. Yeah. That would be incredible theater if you got UConn at NC State. But yeah, the matchup I think most people want to see is UConn and Purdue. A lot of people hate UConn. I don't. I'm more on the side that I just can't stand this Purdue team just because of the way that that Edie has been officiated in a way this year that we've only seen basically Duke teams be officiated in the way that Edie is officiated. So I would love to see UConn put it on Purdue. I know there'll be some. Oh, same deal as Virginia. Yeah, that worked out great for all of us that Tony Bennett and Virginia won a national championship. Well, that worked out awesome for everybody. Now we're stuck watching Virginia play whatever the sport they're playing is. It is basketball, probably for the next 15 years because Bennett won that one title.
Yeah, it's interesting. I find it interesting you said everyone hates UConn. Of course, I'm in Connecticut, so not it's different around here. But I get the sense. I don't get that sense just because I feel like they haven't been that great for that long, where they were so dormant for a good 5-6 years under Ollie in the American Conference, which is a rinky-dink conference. I get the sense that they haven't been that great that long now. Two, three more years of this. Yeah, that's going to happen. But I do find it interesting that you get that sense.
I think it more just has to do that people just can't stand Danny Hurley. Look, he's a crazy person. There's no arguing that. I don't think he's a bad guy or anything like some people were bringing up. Well, no, he's just nuts. I find him very enjoyable. And he's built, it was circulating a few days ago of that quote after Villanova got him in 2020 before the pandemic. It's like, you better get us now.
Yep.
Because once we get this thing rolling, you aren't going to get us. And Hurley's been able to back that up and some, obviously, these last 2 years.
One of the more prescient declarations you'll ever hear. I mean, it really was.
Yeah. No, he's right on. He's spot on.
I mean, you couldn't be more right. And it's funny, this year they were really good in the regular season. They were great in the regular season. They've taken it to another gear in the tournament. Last year they were good, not great in the regular season. They were dominant. So they do hit another gear in this tournament, which is really impressive. It's just not the nature of this tournament to run through 10, 11, 12 games and just kill everybody. I mean, we've seen teams with 7, 8, 9 NBA guys not be able to do this. We've seen Kentucky with that many NBA guys not be able to win a game. And they're just, it's not like they're overly talented in terms of guys that are going to be playing at the next level, but you look up the scoreboard and they're just beating everybody by 20, 30 points. It's really remarkable.
No, it's incredible. It's incredible. And it's funny because last year, Will, I didn't trust them at all. Because if you remember, they were underwater in Big East play well into February last year. And they got to the Big East semifinal, lost there. I think it was Marquette got them in the Big East semifinal.
Got upset by New Mexico State the year before.
Yeah, exactly. In the de facto home game in Buffalo, they got upset by New Mexico State. Teddy Allen, Eddie Allen at New Mexico yes. State, I'm pretty sure, that got Chris Jans the Mississippi State job that win. But no, look, they were not trustworthy at all until, of course, last year they win all the games by 12 plus. This year they're winning all the games by 18 plus. It is remarkable what they have done. And I mean, look, I know people will say, the run hasn't been this impressive this year. I think that's ridiculous. Where, yeah, all right, 16 seed. I thought Northwestern was a pretty solid 9 seed. That game was over before it even started. San Diego State played basically as well as they could have for 20 minutes, and UConn won the game by 30. And then Illinois, I mean, this will get forgotten. Going into the game, Illinois was the number 2 offense in the country, and UConn basically held them to, what was it, I think 0.85 points per possession when it was all said and done. And just domination on both sides of the ball. I really, really have seen nothing like it before, Will. But, hey, look, the NCAA tournament, one and done, can provide some weird stuff. Again, Bama on paper shouldn't scare people because of how bad their defense is. But like I said, man, at high variance, I thought Purdue was the best bet for a side, but there are arguments for Alabama just on the variance of how they play, as I said earlier.
And last thing on this before we do move on to baseball, if it is NC State or UConn, I do think UConn would kill NC State. That being said, there would be a little pressure on UConn because that's a little Patriots-Giants Super Bowl NC State winning a title, and we're a long way from that. They're 9.5-point underdogs, and they would be double-digit underdogs against UConn. That would be maybe the greatest title upset in the history of the tournament, one of the great ones in the history of sports. I don't think that's overstating it to see where they came from in the ACC tournament to actually win the title and beat UConn of all teams to do it. I mean, that's a movie. That's one of the all-timers, if not the all-timer.
I mean, NCAA tournament-wise, I mean, what, Villanova in 85 beating Georgetown in the perfect game, 83 NC State. I mean, like, it's hard. There's nothing in this millennium that even remotely comes close to that. It would have been like if VCU won it all as the 11 seed going first four to title or George Mason. I would actually say
maybe Florida Atlantic last year, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, even when Butler lost to Duke with Gordon Hayward, like Gordon Hayward is a legitimate 13-year pro in the NBA. Ronald Norred played in the NBA. Shelvin Mack played in the NBA. Like, that Purdue team had 3 legitimate NBA players and a great college player, Matt Howard at center. I mean, this was a team that if Tony Bennett – I hate that I've mentioned Virginia multiple times, but if Tony Bennett properly fouls up 3, this never happens. It's over. It's over right then and there. In Washington, D.C., instead, they're playing in Phoenix, and it is crazy. I mean, well, Circa had them at 600-1
win
the title 17 days ago.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they were 600-1 to win the title. It is insane. At what point was that?
That was before the ACC tournament?
That was, I think that was the day the ACC tournament started, if memory serves me correctly.
And that's think about everything they had to go through. An 11-game money line rollover, all as huge underdogs. The 600-1 is light, but that does put it into perspective what we're talking about here.
Yeah, no, I, you know what the funny part of it is, Will? I actually bet Louisville money line in the first game against NC State.
Oh, my God.
In the ACC tournament, thinking, you know what? We know Kenny Payne's getting fired. Maybe they get one great effort, and they were losing at halftime NC State to Louisville, if you remember.
46-45.
Yeah, and it was like, maybe I'm onto something here. And then Louisville did what they did all year and sucked. And NC State's here, which is crazy.
Baseball. We're 4 games in. Your Mets are not doing. We don't talk about your Mets. You can just give me your biggest takeaway from these first 4 days. It's only one series. It's only one weekend, but it is 100% of the sample. So just give me your biggest takeaway here so far.
I mean, I think it's got to be the Yankees, doesn't it? I mean, going to Houston – sweeping 4 and with Garrett Cole on the shelf, no less. That's pretty frightening to everyone in the American League if that's the case, Will, that if this Yankee team is going to be an elite team without Garrett Cole, what happens if Cole's able to actually come back and be healthy? And what if the Yankees are actually willing to finally throw some trade pieces around for a starting pitcher at the deadline? That was far and away the biggest thing that I got from this weekend. And for the Astros, Look, well, before the year, I picked the Braves over the Astros in the World Series. I went chalk in a series where I don't like either of the teams, even though the Braves are just the freaking juggernaut on offense yet again. But I'm stunned that the Yankees did what they were. And honestly, opening day was kind of I know it was a sign of things to come in the series, but that was a pretty big statement on opening day. The way that game went, where Cortez just gets bombed from the get-go, and the Yankees still come from behind and win. I'm not even sure the Yankees would have done something like that last year, too. Honestly, in the last 5 years, I wouldn't even be sure if the Yankees would have done something like that, Will. So that is clearly far and away the biggest story of the weekend. That, the Yankees, even without Gerrit Cole, may still be at the top of the American League. And I will also say, too, I didn't buy the Marlins coming into the year. I thought they were smoking mirrors last year. I thought they were lucky. They were a 75-win team that won all sorts of one-run games last year. I'm not surprised that they looked as bad as they did against the Pirates. I know there's some extra inning variance mixed in there in the four-game sweep for Pittsburgh opening day and on Sunday with the Pirates winning in 10. But I think the Marlins are going to be a monstrous fade because I think they're mispriced. The market has them too high. And I think they're a 72-win team. I think they're even with the Mets looking like garbage this weekend, I still think the Marlins are behind the Mets in the NL East. And the Nationals are bad, but we knew that already.
It's like you listened to my open somehow, which might be the first time you ever listened to my podcast when you listen to open, which – I don't even know how you have access because it's not up yet. I talked about all the same things. I talked about the Marlins being fraud. I talked about that before the season and how this confirmed it. The other end of that, the winning end of that, the Pirates being 4-0. Is this sustainable? Is this just, hey, I think they had a good record to start last year. Plus 850 to win a division. Can they win a bad division with like 86 games, or is that getting way, way ahead of ourselves?
Well, they're in the right division to pop up and surprise, right? I mean, that division's still terrible. The Cubs didn't look particularly great this weekend. Cardinals may be on their way to a split with the Dodgers, which, with the way that series started,
amazing,
would be pretty impressive if they could salvage the final two and get out of L.A. With a 2-2 split. I'm not buying the Cardinals. I still think they're a 77-win team. I don't think they're any good. It comes down to the Pirates and the Reds, right? I mean, I know Milwaukee just had this big weekend, but I think that's more about the Mets more it is about than the Brewers. But look, I think one of those teams, Cincinnati or Pittsburgh, they're going to be in a race the whole way through. And look, if the Pirates pitching holds up, that's the question with both of those teams, health-wise for Cincinnati and just ability-wise for the Pirates. But whichever one of those two teams has their pitching held up better, Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, they're going to be in a race till the end. I still think the Cubs are the best team in that division. But if you told me, like, hey, Pirates win the division at 84-78, Reds win the division at 86-76, I wouldn't be shocked by either of that.
No, I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you. And maybe you bring up Skeens, you know, you got Cruz. Eventually, when you're this bad for like a better part of like a decade, you're picking the top two, top three, unless you're just completely inept at drafting talent, developing talent, like eventually you're just going to run into some good players basically by accident at some point.
Oh, well, I mean that the look at Baltimore. I mean, that's why exactly. The Orioles, now that the Orioles have also competent ownership as well on top of all those guys. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Jackson Holliday's in the minors, but that won't be for long in Norfolk. But no, I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, the Orioles were an abomination for a long while after making the playoffs in the mid-teens, and here they are now. I mean, there's a legitimate argument to be made that the winner of the AL East is going to get the one seed in the American League yet again because of how good Baltimore is and, again, how the Yankees have looked so far in the early goings.
I don't know if you want to talk your Mets, but the one thing we didn't mention with the Yankees, Holmes is an issue. I don't trust Holmes. He could have very easily blown two of these games.
Oh, yeah.
Should have blown the game Sunday. You have a very good closer on your side of town in New York with the Mets. You're not going to be needing him. You're not going to use him. Is there anything we can work out where Diaz, we get him in pinstripes, you bring over the trumpet, you bring over Diaz, and we give you, I don't know, we'll give you something. Can that be worked out? Is that possible?
I mean, Juan Soto with a 7-year extension, I mean, that's fine. Okay.
Time to
no,
go.
I will say for the Mets part of things, look, it's we talked about it after Senga went down. Their starting pitching is very unreliable. And the bigger problem is, other than Saturday, the offense was terrible. And that's a very bad mix of things. McGill is hurt now, looks like, as well. So they're going to even have to go deeper into the farm system that's already lacking arms. It's not good. And I don't want to say anything about, I mean, we're six games into the season by Thursday this week. But you're playing the Tigers, who only look competent because of the opponent they were playing this weekend, because I think the White Sox and the Rockies and the A's are in a league of their own of ineptitude this year. Those three teams are so much worse than everyone else in baseball. But Detroit, I mean, that sweep was because of the White Sox. It wasn't because of them. So if you're the Mets, you got to take 2 or 3 from Detroit. Like, all right, 2-4 is not good to begin the year, but can't get yourself in a 1-5 or, God forbid, 0-6 hole. And then it's like one of those, like for Mendoza. I know he didn't manage on Sunday after the kerfuffle on Saturday. But hey, I still haven't won a game yet. Like, that's kind of a weird pressure that shouldn't be a pressure. But look, it's pretty doom and gloom, man. It's pretty gloomy right now. And you got to think, if this thing doesn't turn, where and what do the Mets send and get for Pete Alonso at the trade deadline? As much as that pains me to say, like trading him midseason and then going full bore after him in the offseason might not be the worst idea for the Mets at this rate, because it does not look like they're close right now.
Seems like they have a lot of faith in Stearns to pull the right strings here. And if you want to feel comfortable, if you want to feel good about Stearns, you can at least look at the team that beat you 3 times and say, hey, he built this Milwaukee team that beat you this weekend. I don't know. Are you in good hands with Stearns, or it's too early to tell?
I mean, Milwaukee made the playoffs 5 out of 6 years with no budget, other than basically the Yelich deal was the only primo name that they got. And that was because Miami was cheapos. We'll see. It's too early to judge. But again, they half-assed it this offseason. They really did. They got themselves stuck in between, which is, as you know, the worst spot to be going into a year. And look, going into the year, until the Diamondbacks signed Montgomery, it was like, all right, you know what, maybe the Mets can get lucky, win 84, 85 games. Maybe that's enough. Now, I think all three of those teams in the West behind the Dodgers are significantly better than them. We know the Phillies are already better than the Mets, so you're out of spots. So you're stuck. You're stuck in the middle, which is a very bad spot to be right now.
All right, last one before we go here. Last time you were on, I don't think the Jets had signed any of these offensive linemen, so we just assumed, hey, that first pick, I think it's the 10th pick, is going to be an offensive lineman. Has that thought process changed? Where do you think the Jets go here, your Jets for the 10th pick in the draft?
In all honesty, Will, as long as they don't go pass rusher, I don't really care at this rate. Just don't do anything stupid with
them. So you're okay with Bowers, you're okay with the receiver, you're okay with an offensive
lineman. Bowers would be awesome. The Jets have not had a player like that in my lifetime. I mean, it's arguable that Dustin Keller is the best tight end the Jets have had in my lifetime. The position has been pretty barren over the years, especially of late. And I like Conklin. I think he's a good player. I think as a 3, he would be spectacular. Or as a 2, I should say, behind Bowers, he would be spectacular. I don't think any of the 3 primo wide receivers will be there. I don't think Adunze falls. Neighbors not getting out of the top 5 at this point. Definitely not getting past 6, because I think McCarthy's going in the top 4 at this point. I think someone's going to trade with Arizona.
Let's go through it. Rattle them off if you don't mind. Your mock draft.
Well, I think will happen at this point, obviously Caleb Williams, despite the fact that everyone seems to be picking on the kid, for non-football reasons, which is just stupid because the kid is such a good player. And he'll end up being the best quarterback the Bears have had since Sammy Baugh. He's going 1. I would personally take Jaden Daniels at 2 if I were the Commanders, but I think they're going to take Drake May. And I'm not buying the McCarthy noise at 2. I think that's too ridiculous. The people out here, man, really think the Raiders are going to move up. We know the connection with Antonio Pierce, and Marvin Lewis is on the staff with the Raiders as well. I mean, they were on the coaching staff with Irm that had Jaden Daniels at Arizona State. So there is a connection there. Daniels is going 3. I don't know the destination yet. Obviously, Minnesota loaded up, but I think that's for McCarthy. I think Minnesota is the team that moves up to 4 and takes them there. And then that leaves the Chargers and the Giants. I mean, Marvin Harrison Jr. to replace losing Keenan Allen, and Mike Williams is pretty damn good for Harbaugh and Herbert at the Chargers. And then Neighbors goes six to Big Blue. That's what I think ends up happening there, which would then Adunze will go somewhere in that 8 to 9 range because Tennessee will take a tackle at 7, which then leaves the Jets probably in that scenario with Bowers or whichever offensive lineman they like the most. Taking an old lineman at 10 is still good. I mean, look at who they signed. Morgan Moses and Tyron Smith are one-year fixes, more likely than not, and they're really good one-year fixes. But you need to have someone behind him. Tyron Smith hasn't played 16 games in 17 games, or whatever it is. 16 games actually works for that because he hasn't played a full season since they moved to the 17 games. So I would take the tackle. I would take, personally, Will, I would take a tackle unless if one of the big three wide receivers got to the Jets at number 10. I'd probably take Fuga. Alt's the dream, but he's not getting past 7. But I would probably take Fuga over the kid from Penn State. I think Fuga is a more sure bet at this rate.
Jeff, I appreciate you coming on. It's always fun. You are the first person in history, not only appear three times, but the first person in history of this podcast to use the word kerfuffle. So you've made history multiple times already. Let everyone know where they can find you.
I aim to please, Will. On the tweets at Jeff Parles. Sports by the Book is the show. Weekdays, that's 6 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific. Weekends, 11:30 a.m. Eastern, 8:30 Pacific. South Point Studio on YouTube is the easiest way to get us.
And I will say, it is very good. I text with the Bear all the time, and Gil, I was like, man, I miss these guys. I miss listening to them on VSiN, Chris, Vinny, you. So it is very good for those of you that haven't listened. So, Jeff, appreciate you coming on. We'll do this again soon.
Will, always a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
All right, that will do it. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Jeff Parles. We'll be back Wednesday, talk more baseball, Final Four, getting close to the NBA playoffs, NFL draft. So fun time of the year. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe. See you guys Wednesday.